The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
I think it's a pivotal moment in European history. It's a pivotal moment in world history. I haven't seen anything like this since, I guess, the Balkans crisis was the last time we had a crisis of this scale in terms of threatening the underlying rules-based order.
And what would you assess as the risk now of further escalation from Russia? Does Putin stop here, or does he go further?
I don't think he can stop here. If his intention all along was to recognize the two breakaway republics, then you wouldn't need 150,000, 160,000 troops. You wouldn't need amphibious assault vehicles, missiles in Belarus, troops in Belarus. I think he's going to go further.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, that's a concerning thought, isn't it? I think they're right. I think he makes a great point there. A lot of news developing regarding Vladimir Putin, regarding the Ukraine, and I'll bring you up to speed on it all. Good afternoon. I'm Drew Mariani. Thank you for joining us. Again, I call you to be at peace, not to fear, and of course, always to pray. Big news today, and that is that Russia has sent troops into Ukraine after the president of Russia, after Vladimir Putin said yesterday that he would recognize two eastern regions with, you know, Russian leanings as being independent countries. Again, you know, let me just go back just a little bit. Remember that Vladimir Putin says, these are just military exercises. We are not going to invade Ukraine. These are simple exercises. Yet, you know, they set up amphibious type of vehicles and weaponry and did nuclear drills and brought blood into their medical tents and they're just drills. Do you really need to do all that? The EU has stopped just short of calling it an invasion. Okay, I'm not sure what else you can call it personally from where I sit. I do understand this gray area that they're in. But right now, people are fleeing, and Russia has hit at least one power station in one of those regions. The EU has unanimously decided on imposing economic sanctions on Russia, though they're not as tough as they could be. The president has addressed the country literally moments ago. You may not have heard this. Maggie's been able to grab some audio for you. Thought we'd play just a little bit of the president's address. Listen.
So I'm going to begin to impose sanctions in response far beyond the steps we and our allies and partners implemented in 2014. And if Russia goes further with this invasion, we stand prepared to go further as with sanctions. Who in the Lord's name does Putin think gives him the right to declare new so-called countries on territory that belong to his neighbors? This is a flagrant violation of international law and demands a firm response from the international community.
And the president went on warning about the ratcheting up of those sanctions and where this all could lead. I mean, he did say in that address to the nation that we will respond to Vladimir Putin's actions, not his words. And he said one thing, and he's doing another. Germany, who was kind of tepid on this whole thing, they sent about 5,000 helmets to the to Ukrainian soldiers when everyone else is sending, you know, jets and anti-aircraft carriers and Stingers and a whole bunch of anti-aircraft carriers, tank weaponry and a whole litany of other stuff. Germany was soft. However, they are now on board. Germany said it will not sign off on the building of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Russia. And look, just to put that in perspective, that will be a major, major economic hit, really, for the world's largest country. The U.S. is also imposing sanctions. The sanctions are there are sanctions aimed more at, I believe, Americans than at Russians. No Americans can invest in the breakaway regions. And the action is already having global implications, not just in terms of warfare. I was looking at the stock market right before coming on. It was dropping right before my broadcast. It was probably down about 500 points or so. Stock markets aren't happy with it. They're down 1%. So a lot of people are getting back to gold. Oil. And we'll talk about this coming up a little later, too. Oil prices and gas prices are going up in response to the New York Times, going up in response to this. I think oil is $94 a barrel. I bet it'll be even higher than that next time I take a look at it. But the New York Times reported one expert said that those increases should shave about 1% off the United States gross domestic product. And, when it comes to our GDP, That's not good news because it's going to push the inflation rate up. We're, I think, about 7% now. It's going to be up to 10%. So you may wonder why Ukraine matters so much. You know, why does Vladimir Putin want this so desperately? Why is he, you know, why is he willing to risk not only heavy sanctions, but possible global war? Ukraine is really a very rich territory. I believe it's the second largest country there in Europe in the breadbasket there. I think it's the largest country in Europe, actually. I stand corrected. It's the largest country in Europe. And they call it the breadbasket of Europe because it can meet the food needs of about 600 million people. So it has real potential, of course. You can see why Vladimir Putin would want that. Plus, it has all kinds of mineral reserves that are very important. There's things like iron and manganese and titanium and uranium. And Russia definitely wants uranium, you know, and it's, of course, it's also an important industrial nation, you know, making locators and locating equipment and rocket launchers and steel and exporting things like clay and titanium and ores and concentrates. So if that now falls under Russian hands and control, you can understand the significance of that to the world, but also to Vladimir Putin. So the chess game continues. Things are now ratcheting up. The president, NATO have responded strongly. We'll see what Vladimir Putin does next. Our on our own side of the pond, if you will, our own neighbors to the north, we've been following what's happening with the prime minister there, Justin Trudeau, and he invoked the Emergency Act. Well, the Canadian lawmakers there actually voted to extend the federal government's emergency powers, and they actually are going to grant the prime minister powerful tools to punish those who are involved in this trucker protest. Listen to this.
If you are involved in this protest, we will actively look to identify you and follow up with financial sanctions and criminal charges.
Canada's Parliament is extending Prime Minister Trudeau's emergency powers used to crack down on convoy supporters, but Conservatives say it's being used to target law-abiding citizens like a mom who donated a small sum of money to the movement.
That is unconscionable. How is this tolerated in a democracy?
Well, quite frankly, I think Trudeau just declared his country to be a dictatorship, not a democracy. It's something that you shouldn't see in the United States, you shouldn't see in Canada, something that you more likely see in places like Venezuela, Cuba, or China. But I want to talk about our government, because the fact that our leaders have not stood up and said anything about this, about our neighbors to the north and what they're doing to their citizens and the robbing of their civil rights and liberties and, quite frankly, their voice, the fact that our leaders have said nothing about it is what truly concerns me, and I believe it's because they relish the idea of doing something very similar in the United States should a convoy come. And I believe that they also want to have that on the table to weaponize against their political opponents.
But that's actually food for thought, isn't it? We know that there's going to be an American convoy similar to what we saw in Canada. It's going to start in California, make its way to our nation's capital. What kind of response will we see? I think, I'm hoping the U.S. can learn from the mistakes that perhaps Canada has made. I'm sure we'll see a wall go up. I'm sure they're already planning to address this. But, you know, we are the United States of America. We believe in the right to protest. We believe in civil disobedience. And I'm hoping we're not going to see violence, a freezing of accounts, or a lot of imprisonments. But we'll see ultimately what happens here. We'll track that story for you. That's developing now. Canada, though, just one final thought on what we're seeing there. Under the law in Canada, Parliament has to give approval within 7 days of its invocation. Otherwise, it's considered an invalid act. But a good majority did approve it. Some did reluctantly because Trudeau said that the vote, that he would consider it a vote of confidence if they approved it. And legislators weren't happy with that, but they voted for it anyway because they didn't want to be seen as not having confidence in Trudeau. And that means the act is going to be in place now for 30 days from when it was first invoked. But the trucker protest, the convoy in Canada is virtually over. We'll see if anything else percolates or pops back up. One other story here I would like to just bring to your attention, something I've been following for a while, and I've been keeping you in the loop on this, and that is this continuing violence against Catholic churches. And I'm just looking at what's happening in the world here, just through the eyes of prophecy, through the eyes of history, And it always gives me pause when I see the church attacked. I mean, look what's happening in Europe, and we haven't seen this type of activity. And I can't imagine how long. I mean, is it potential? Could we see another European war? I pray to God not. Clearly, I think Satan is afoot. His hallmark is division. You know, he hates life. He hates family. He revels in this type of stuff. And quite often before nations erupted in great violence, and I often share the story of what happened in Rwanda, Africa, before the genocide that took place there, there was an attack on all things that were holy, on churches, and especially on statues. Well, there was a 300-pound statue of the Holy Family. It was stolen from in front of the Parish Activity Center, St. Mary Magdalene Parish, in San Antonio, Texas, last week. Listen to this. The congregation of St. Margaret Mary Catholic Church, they're praying right now for the return of what they call a sacred statue that they believe was stolen. This report comes from KSAT News. Listen.
So this is something that you just never think somebody would steal from a church. We're talking about a sacred statue of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph right here. Someone actually took it from the St. Margaret Mary Church just southeast of downtown. Our Daphne Gray spoke with the church's pastor, who says that they are praying for the statue's safe return.
When I back my truck in, I always look across the parking lot. I say a prayer to the Holy Family, and on Thursday, right before Mass, it was gone.
Father Jimmy Drennan of St. Margaret Mary Catholic Church is talking about the statue of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. He believes sometime last Wednesday night, the sacred statue was stolen. Father Drennan says burglaries have happened before, but nothing like this.
It kind of hit a high point when the statue of the Holy Family, which has been here for 40 years, that statue in front of our activity center, was removed overnight and has just disappeared.
Now, I'm 5'4", but if you look at the foundation this statue was sitting on, it's nearly chest level to me, which is why church leaders are trying to figure out how someone was able to lift the statue to begin with. Again, a statue that weighs at least 300 pounds. There's no question that to move something like this with basic human strength, impossible.
I imagine it took a team effort for them to do this. It was more than one person. We're thinking that it may be in an alleyway. Someone may have stolen it as a prank and dropped it someplace.
He says not having the statue is a tragedy, not just for the church, but for the community.
The image of the Holy Family represents the unity that this community has as one family. We must first pray for those who have stolen the statue, and then do everything we can to have it returned.
If you have any information on the statue's whereabouts, you are encouraged to call SAPD.
You know, it's say a prayer. I know you may not be living in the state of Texas right now, but ask God to return that or to bring about a conversion in the hearts of those who perpetrated it. 40 years, you know, in that location, as you point out, you know, it was not one individual who took it. They believe multiple people were responsible for that threat. So I'm sure it was premeditated and coordinated. And I think it was probably more than a prank. Yeah, I have a friend who lives in the city of Rochester, where the Mayo Clinic is located. And he had a beautiful statue of St. Michael outside of his home. And it was done by a very prominent artist. And it was stolen recently, too. And I said to him, I said, you know, I don't know if you're ever going to find it. He put out pleas. He put out a reward, all sorts of things. Could it be kids? You know, there's a lot of Satanism in this country, too. And in Minneapolis, the state of Minnesota in particular, has a lot of covens. And I often think, could be a spiritual thing here, too. So we're seeing more of this. I'll continue to bring it to you. Again, just a call to you to pray for it. On another note, the battle for life in this country continues. And this is really, I just think we're going to see so much more of it. The Constitutional Court in Colombia today recognized abortion in the first 24 weeks of pregnancy. That's up to 6 months, which is pretty extreme when compared to the rest of the world. But here in our country, right, it may get worse than that. I came across a story over the weekend. I was reading about a bill in the Senate that if, and I want to underline if, and I pray to God it doesn't, if it passes, it will be extremely dangerous for the lives of unborn children in our country. And we're currently waiting for the Supreme Court, of course, to rule on the Dobbs case from Mississippi, which I personally believe will more than likely overturn Roe v. Wade, but I don't think we're going to hear that decision to the end of their session in June. So we still have more time to go, more months to pray. The Democratic Party, however, isn't waiting to see if that's going to happen or not. I think they're concerned that it will get overturned. So they're trying to make sure that that dark sacrament, if you will, that abortion remains legal from conception all the way through to birth. And to make that happen, they put forward a bill. There's a bill ironically called, and you'll love this, and this is the stuff that just frustrates the blank out of me. It's called Women's Health Protection Act. I mean, they have all these beautiful sanitary reproductive justice, the Women's Health Protection Act, the equality. I mean, they have all these titles that all sound so good if you didn't really know what was underneath of them. Critics, those who really know what it's all about, they call it the Abortion on Demand Until Birth Act. Let's call it for what it really is, okay? You know, abortion on demand up until the birth act. I say, yeah, now I know what it's about, women's health protection. I'm all about protecting women's health, but I certainly am not for destroying an innocent life in the womb. So, you know, this bill, if it gets passed, just to put it in perspective, it could wipe out all the pro-life laws across the country. Yeah, you heard me right. You said, what did he say? It would wipe out all pro-life laws across the country. Any pro-life law there is, informed consent, waiting periods, parental consent, judicial review for minors, you know, the litany of them, all of those and more, they would be erased from the books. So to put this in perspective, to allow you to understand the significance of what may happen, I've invited the Vice President of Communications for the Susan B. Anthony list. Mallory Carroll joins us. You can find out more by going to their website, sbalist.org, if you want to read up on this and find out what's happening and how you can make a difference. Mallory, good to have you with me. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Drew. It's so good to be with you. And man, this you explained the bill very well there. And words matter. You know, our opponents who support abortion on demand up until the moment of birth, they have been engaged since the beginning of time, you know, to try and make things sound better, it's deception is what it is. And this Women's Health Protection Act is actually renamed and rebranded version of the Freedom of Choice Act, which maybe you or listeners would recall from the early 2010s. And so this is the impact of this legislation would be that if your state has passed any pro-life bill regulating the circumstances around which an abortion occurs, so limiting abortion when the baby can feel pain, or anti-discrimination laws that protect babies from being aborted because they've been diagnosed with Down syndrome or because they're a girl, even things that are meant to protect women, like informed consent laws and waiting periods to make sure that mothers they have all the information at their fingertips before they go about this procedure, undergo this procedure. This would undo every state law passed up until this point. And it really speaks to the change that we have right now. You mentioned the Dobbs case. We're waiting on the Supreme Court to take the handcuffs off the states and allow states to pass laws that reflect the values of the people that live there. And so this is the response of the abortion lobby. It is to try and push this radical piece of legislation while they have a pro-abortion president in the White House and a pro-abortion majority in Congress. And it's the same thing that they're doing with chemical abortion, amping up the expansion of chemical abortion because they are so afraid of the will of the people being put into law at the state level.
Yeah, I think they know. I'm sure they probably have a sense that Roe, as we know, it's going to fall. If it's not now, it will fall. So these preemptive measures, I think they see as critical. Has the bill gone through the House yet? Where are we in terms of the process?
So Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, he filed cloture on the bill at the end of last week. So this means that it's going to be voted on, we're expecting, this coming Monday. It has not gone through the House yet, and they would need to get at least 10 Republican votes in the House. So, but we have very tight margins in both chambers. So this is why, you know, we have to stay vigilant. Because it likely will pass the Senate. And this is should be a grave concern for all Americans, because it would affect, no matter what state you're living in, it would affect you. This is actually the first time that there's going to be a vote on this legislation. There was not a vote on the Freedom of Choice Act, which was the previous iteration of this extreme bill. But it shows the length that the abortion lobby is going to. And it's only coming up for a vote now because of the pressure from the abortion groups and the far left. They're dissatisfied. You know, it's interesting. I was talking to a reporter at a national mainstream outlet last week, and she was talking about the rhetoric that both sides use. And I said, you know what? Call me anti-abortion.
Right.
I am against abortion. And here's what abortion is. Meanwhile, President Biden has never, because here's the thing, here was the impetus for the story that she was writing. The Planned Parenthood and pro-abortion groups are calling on President Biden to support this legislation and to talk about it by name at the State of the Union in a week or so.
Lord.
And he has never, apparently, I mean, the pro-abortion groups are tracking this, has never said the word abortion, and neither has Jen Psaki, his press secretary. I said, that's because the abortion conjures up images. Everyone knows what this means.
Sure.
And a life of an unborn human child is being taken brutally, and a woman is being wounded. They don't want to say abortion. They want to call it women's health, reproductive justice,
right.
All of these euphemisms for the violence of this procedure. So when you hear people talking about the Women's Health Protection Act, don't be fooled. It's the Abortion Until Birth Act.
Yeah, words have meaning. It frustrates me to no end. I talk, you know, for a living every day, and I understand the power of words to form thoughts, to move hearts. And when you call it for what it really is, if you say, hey, this is abortion on demand up until birth, people would say, what? But when you say, hey, this is women's health protection, you know, or it's all about reproductive justice, you know, it's about choice. They all sound great, you know, but it's not really what it's about. That's a whitewash on a corrupt tomb is what it is, on a decaying body. And it is so frustrating, and especially I happen to be Catholic. Joe Biden professes to be Catholic. To advance something like this, to see Chuck Schumer, to see those in the Democratic Party so willing to advance the culture of death, I have such a problem understanding how anybody who has a monochrome of intelligence can justify or make sense of this. I really can't. Maybe one day I'll be able to comprehend how they can do that. Now, right now, I understand the Senate is split between Republicans and Democrats, though, you know, I can imagine two Republicans who will vote for it. You got Murkowski from Alaska. You got Susan Collins from Maine. But there's a couple Democrats who are going to vote against it. You got guys like Joe Manchin, who I don't think is going to support this. So how does the vote look?
That's right. Senator Manchin, we hope, will not vote for this legislation. He has been a stalwart on the Hyde Amendment, which stops taxpayer funding of abortion. But listen, talk about disappointment for Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Casey, who's a senator from Pennsylvania, whose father, he's a Democrat. His father was a Democrat governor of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and a very outspoken pro-life leader. He was actually banned from attending the Democratic National Convention some decades ago because he had been so outspoken on the pro-life issue. He announced last week that he's going to, he will vote for cloture, which is the first step. So in the Senate, you had to file for cloture. There's a cloture vote, and then there's a second vote on the substance of the bill. But the first vote is really a vote on the substance because it's giving credence to this idea that somehow women's health is promoted and protected by abortion on demand up until the moment of birth, which we know is an all-out lie. And so it is true we are split, but the problem in the Senate is that when you're even, the Vice President, Kamala Harris, is cast a tie-breaking vote.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's going to be very close, and these tight margins just remind us of the consequences of elections and why this stuff really matters, because we need the right people in office in order to pass the right kind of pro-life laws.
Well, we'll continue to follow the story here as it develops. And if people want more information, what's the best way to get that?
Please visit our website. You mentioned it at the top of the interview, sbalist.org. We are going to have action alerts that you'll that will be easy to navigate to off the homepage, and we'll be keeping everyone updated there.
All right. Well, Mallory, thank you for your time and for your eloquence. We'll continue to monitor this. We'll certainly continue to pray for it as well. Mallory is the Vice President of Communication for the Susan B. Anthony List. Check them out, sbalist.org. This is a nefarious, downright dark and evil bill, and it has nothing to do with protecting women's health. It has everything to do about destroying the life of an innocent child up to birth. Do your part. Call your legislator. Above all, praying. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Get caught up on that conversation you missed by going to the Relevant Radio archives. Just select The Drew Mariani Show.
Well, it's good to be with you today. Thank you for joining me. It's always a delight to be able to give you a look at what's unfolding in the world and hopefully apply a moral perspective or lens to that. As you heard earlier, Russia has sent troops into the eastern region of Ukraine and the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. Right now, the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, has declared them to be independent countries, justifying his move into them, saying, hey, you know what, this is not an invasion, we're peacekeepers. You know, one man's peacekeeper is another man's invader, and he is now calling those regions the People's Republic. So if it sounds kind of communist, you're right. It is, right? It is. The EU has responded with financial sanctions that have targeted the members of the Duma who voted in favor of supporting Putin, as well as some of the leaders in those regions. Germany has also suspended licensing the Nord to Stream 2 gas pipeline, which runs from Russia to Germany. I've always thought that was a major mistake. I wish we could have supplied our European allies with the energy that they need. When you have Russia supplying that, it makes them dependent on it. And of course, we remember what the president did the first day of taking the Oval Office with his executive pen and executive orders. We know what happened to the Keystone Pipeline. We know all these what he's done to energy policy in this country. And a little bit later, we will talk about the connection between energy and national security. But here in the U.S., the president spoke probably about an hour ago addressing this, talking about sanctions that are going to be levied. But at the same time, legislators are preparing a package that would really punish Russia. They'd also give aid to Ukraine, including selling them more weapons. It would allow the Defense Department to fund troop deployments to NATO countries to the north and to the west of Ukraine. But the punishment would hit at the wealthy oligarchs who are supporting Putin. And President Biden said that this would be just the very first installment. There's more to come. This is first. That as Russia advances into Ukraine, he's going to turn up the heat on them. He says, I'm not going to listen to Putin's words. We're going to respond to his actions. And of course, the question is whether this will be enough to get Putin's attention and force him to cease his actions, or is his mind made up? Is there an off-ramp for Vladimir Putin right now? How do we get out of this without any bloodshed? I'm joined today by Dakota Wood. He served in the United States Marine Corps for a couple decades, senior research fellow right now for defense programs at the Heritage Foundation, and the author of their annual report, The Index of U.S. Military Strength, and you should check that out. I think it's give you an interesting perspective on where we stand. And it's good to talk with you again, Dakota. I appreciate you always making time for the program.
No, it's just a blessing to be with you every time. I wish we had happier things to discuss, but it's just the nature of the world. So
That's so true. There's so much to talk about here. Let me get your take on energy first. I didn't plan on talking about this. I'll dive into it a little bit later. But, you understand our military strength. I mean, these policies, these environmental policies that were put into place have compromised, energy. And energy and national security, they are linked. I'd love your perspective on that. What has the Biden administration done, and has it hurt at all our position in the world in terms of national security?
Well, yes to the latter in terms of harming our position, but to the former, there isn't anything I can think of in the international domain that differs markedly from what our personal lives are. If you have no financial savings or any kind of buffer to shield you from disruptions, you know, you get laid off at work or a snowstorm, makes it difficult to deliver milk to the grocery store, you can't get there or what have you, then you are completely dependent on the goodwill of others or on the predatory behavior of others, right? And so these energy policies that moved us away from being energy dependent now make us very sensitive to global, you know, energy market prices. Germany has done this as national policy. They decommissioned half of their nuclear power plants to go to more of a green energy sort of route, as if, you know, nuclear power plants don't have zero emissions anyway. But anyway, they've become very, very dependent. Half of their energy comes from Russia. Mm-hmm. So now you are at the mercy of a country like Russia to turn on or off gas prices, you know, to raise the cost or not, to the extent that Europe becomes destabilized and that destabilization spreads more broadly. You'll see dramatic increases in the price per barrel of oil. I think we're already at $100. You know, that could go up another 50%, if not double. Wow. And back here at home, then, it ripples back to price per gallon at the pump for the consumer. Mm-hmm. And then you want to go to the store to buy, you know, bread or milk or watermelon or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Now, because it was more expensive to get that to market, you see that ripple then across markets, right? So we'll see an increase in price across everything because everything depends on energy. And you know, this is one of the major exports of Russia. So they've got that as this massive lever where they can throw their weight around Europe. And because of our federal policies, canceling Keystone and these other things that you mentioned, right? You know, refusing drilling up in the Alaska Natural Wildlife Refuge and other places, it makes us more sensitive to these shocks to global markets.
Yeah. Well, I was surprised to see, you know, Vladimir Putin go in. I was thinking that maybe he was amping up, you know, his position in an effort to maybe get something without having to actually invade. He's not calling it an invasion. It's kind of a gray area. Even the White House and other areas are kind of parsing this. How do you view this? Is it an incursion? Is he going into a region that is not Ukraine? Is this a full-scale invasion? How do you see what's unfolding right now?
Well, if an invasion means taking territory that doesn't belong to you, then absolutely this is an invasion. It's kind of like a mafia that comes into a city and they've got their protection racket. And they set fire to your neighbor's store, and then they come in and say, "Hey, I hate to see something bad happen to you. You know, if you pay me $100 a month, you know, these things won't happen." So he goes in and he foments discontent. He arms these separatist rebels in eastern Ukraine, keeps them viable and effective for far longer than they would be on their own, and so effectively controls that part of Ukraine. And now, because he recognizes them as independent countries, and then they ask for his assistance, he moves in at last count 10,000 troops, and reports coming out of Ukraine right now are heavy armor, meaning tanks and other sorts of weapons, are moving to the front lines. So you will have the prospect of Russian military engaging with Ukrainian military. And who do you think is going to win that fight at the outset? So in his big, long speech yesterday, Putin didn't talk about the Soviet Union as something to be reclaimed. It was Tsarist Russia, stretching from the Central Asian republics, the stands, right, Uzbekistan, Kurdistan, these places, all the way west to include half of Europe, you know, the former Soviet republics, to include the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. So he has massive ambitions, and he's just going to continue to eat away at territory, physical terrain, with hard military power. He doesn't give a hoot about economic sanctions. I mean, you know, North Korea has been a pariah state since 1950, and they have a fully-fledged nuclear program. So if you have the political will and the craftiness, you can find ways to get money to feed your military machine, and that's what Putin's all about.
My guest today, Dakota Wood, if you want to join us, we'll open the phones. You can get in at 888-914-9149. Feel free to ask your question or join the conversation. It's 888-914-9149. Yeah, I'm curious as to whether, you know, we saw what happened with Crimea. Now he's in these regions. Will he take over Ukraine. I had shared a little bit earlier how rich in natural resources Ukraine actually is, from being the breadbasket and the largest country in Europe to having uranium and titanium and manganese and all these other elements that and minerals that the Russia could really find value in. But is that enough? Will he roll past that? Is Putin going to stop with these two regions? You know, there was a picture of a power plant in one of those regions that had been hit by shells. And if he wants them, why is he blowing up those infrastructures? So how far do you think he will actually go? Where's the limit? I mean, I heard one person say if he really wanted to, he could roll straight across Europe. I don't think he'd do that. But, you know this better than me, Dakota. So how do you see it?
Yeah, I think it's an incremental approach. He's an opportunist at heart, right? He'll push and push and push and find where there are openings or a lack of resistance, and then he moves in. And once you have settled yourself, it's very hard to undo that.
Right,
you know, I mean,
right.
Nobody is talking about using NATO forces or U.S. unilateral forces or anything like that to retake Crimea, you know, on behalf of Ukraine. Ukraine can't do it himself. So he will continue to push. And again, going back to this former Soviet republic, you know, places like Moldova and Romania and Bulgaria, Slovakia, right? All those things, you know, Bosnia and Herzegovina, he would love to continue to kind of push that boundary, you know, forward. And you don't have to make, you know, an old, you know, German Wehrmacht blitzkrieg sort of thing, you know, through the Netherlands and Belgium. You can just do this incrementally. You know, you move your boundary further forward, and that incremental movement isn't sufficient for somebody to say, that's it, no more, we're going to attack you. Right. But dominate the terrain with your physical power. And so that's what he is doing incrementally in Ukraine. And we'll continue to see him push westward. He has now a permanent position in Belarus, which is to the north of Ukraine and the east of Poland. That then situates him where if he wanted to, he could move right into Lithuania. And he doesn't have to take the upper three states there, those three Baltic countries. He can just move through Belarus to the southern part of Lithuania and have a land corridor to Kaliningrad, which is Russian, and say, you know, hey, we can't, you know, move supplies, therefore, to support fellow Russians in Kaliningrad, we'll do that. So it's this incrementalism, you know, with guns at the front, and he just does what he wants to do, and the rest of Europe is afraid to commit themselves in any way, and if they ignore it, maybe the problem goes away, but of course it never does. You know, never does. A criminal element in town never goes away until the citizenry and the police department stand up against them.
You're right. No doubt about that. We see that with defunding the police in various parts of our own country. Hey, I have to take a short pause. When we come back, I would love your assessment on what will come next. We can talk about whether or not, you know, I know we're sending more troops and other support, but what about cyber attacks? What's China's relationship now with Russia? I know that they had pulled back a little bit. They don't want to see this escalate either. They still kind of need to the U.S. But we'll take a look at the big picture and what might be coming and how it may affect U.S., the U.S. and its citizenry right after this.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy begins soon on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, we'll pray for peace. I think it's important to do that. So often we take it for granted. Right, good afternoon. It's good to be with you today. I'm Drew Mariani. I'm joined by a longtime contributor to the program, Dakota Wood, served our nation for years in the United States Marine Corps. Is now Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation. Check them out at heritage.org and do a quick search for the Index of U.S. Military Strength as well. We're talking, if you're just joining us, about the latest developments regarding Vladimir Putin and Russia's incursion into Ukraine. What does it mean? How far will he go? What will the global response to this be? And how do we get out of this diplomatically? Is there an off-ramp for Vladimir Putin? You know, I do want to pick up on this is such a weird situation. It's not like he's gone into a NATO country, right? Where Article 5 would be issued and it'd be black and white to be clear. He went into Ukraine. Ukraine is not a NATO member. So in theory, you know, we really don't have to go to their aid. But, you know, so does this really warrant U.S. involvement. We don't want another war. The president came out recently and says, we don't want war with Vladimir Putin. We don't have to fight him. But given Ukraine's strategic importance with minerals and agriculture and manufacturing, access to the Black Sea, should we? I'd love your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I would be one of the last to say, hey, let's introduce American forces into Ukraine. I mean, the Ukrainian people have to show that they're willing to save their own country, right, and engage in that. And then we support them with, you know, munitions and equipment and all the things that they need. Where it is in our strategic interest to get involved in some way is if Vladimir Putin and Russia taking Ukraine, now having essentially effectively taken Belarus, I mean, they've got a permanent presence there now, threatening the Baltics, threatening the viability of NATO as a whole, threatening those Eastern European countries that had escaped the Soviet Union when the USSR collapsed. If all of that is important, then it begs the question of how do they get stopped, right? I mean, Germany should have done things, and Italy and France and Spain, and keeping their own militaries strong, which they haven't, and being more willing to get involved in European matters. So to the extent that they are not doing that, well, bad on them, but we can't just say, well, then we write off Europe. I mean, you know, one of our largest trading blocks, and the implications that has on markets and jobs here at home and exports and all those other sorts of things. So we should get angry that we are having to step into an issue that we shouldn't have had to step into to begin with, right? But you can't just write that off. And just like we saw with the debacle and how the withdrawal from Afghanistan occurred, if the view is the United States doesn't care, where it's not important enough for them to get involved, well, then what do countries like South Korea and Japan and Australia, right, and these other, I mean, what is the nature of U.S. reputation? Because, again, all this has to do with peace and prosperity here at home. Again, you know, jobs, exports, low prices, low energy prices. You know, we're part of a global neighborhood, and so we should be concerned about what happens in the next block or two away from us, because eventually it comes to our shores.
I was saying, you know, like, I would not be comfortable at all as a country if Vladimir Putin decided to put some missiles in Cuba, right? We saw what happened during the Kennedy regime, and I can understand him not wanting Ukraine being a member of NATO, you know, with missiles 500 miles, you know, outside of Moscow. However, you know, we live in a different time, and you know this better than anybody. I mean, China's demonstrating hypersonic missiles. Russia claims to have those as well. I mean, they can launch a missile in 3 minutes. I mean, they're almost indefensible right now. Does it matter, you know, right now, you know, in terms of where we are positioned? And can this, here's the other thing, can this escalate into a global war? That's a big concern for a lot of people. Are the U.S. and NATO in a position militarily to fight Russia if he decides he's not content with just taking Ukraine? And how big can this get?
Yeah, this is where the contradiction starts to come in, right? A low-level sort of thing, why should that generate this kind of overwhelming response? You're making something bigger of it than what it needs to be. And yet when you piece together a great number of these low-level things, all of a sudden you have a massive problem that is infinitely harder to undo, right? You know, it's this incrementalism. And so China and Russia are both very skillful at doing this. You know, China, if you recall, some years ago, building these artificial islands, right? And nobody protested. You know, you wouldn't go to war with that. But then they harden the islands, they militarize them, they deploy military power, and now they have the ability, you know, to threaten Malaysian and Vietnamese fishing fleets and declare, you know, no-fly zones and put in air defense, you know, missile systems and those sorts of things. Well, how did that come to be? Well, it's because nobody took it seriously there at the very beginning. So it's just this muscular physical incrementalism that Putin is using to reassert Russian influence, right, and coercion and intimidation on Europe, and we haven't had to deal with that for 30 years, you know, and so it's come back. This is history coming back, and woe to us. I mean, bad on us if we don't recognize these danger signals and kind of gird ourselves, right, and reinvest in what goes on in Europe, because what goes on in Europe affects us back home. And we have a single infantry brigade in Italy. We've got a single light armor. It's a striker brigade in Germany. No heavy armor, only about six fighter squadrons in all of Europe. We sent 5,000 more infantry over on the president's order. And so today in his little speech, he said about repositioning some of those forces already in Europe. What that says is nothing new coming from the United States. Yeah. So whereas Russia has 1,400 tanks surrounding Ukraine, Germany has fewer than 300 in its entire inventory. I mean, this is more than half of Russia's total military that's being applied against this Ukrainian situation. So to say that they're not invading is just, a demonstrable lie.
Yeah. I'm with you. I'm curious as to China's relationship with this as well, too, because, you know, it was a couple of weeks ago, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin got together. They want to strengthen their relationship. And yet I believe I was reading an article the other day, or I'd heard somebody who was on the air with me talk about how, you know, China doesn't really want to see this escalate. They still need us for their financial, I don't want to say independence, but for their strength and for the market that we are and what we mean to them in terms of the things that we're able to provide. So China was not a fan of Russia going in and taking over Ukraine either. Where's China on this, and what's the current relationship between China and Russia?
Yeah, well, a dealer doesn't want to kill the addict that keeps buying his drugs, right? I mean, he wants to have that flow of money coming in. China doesn't want the United States to go away, but a weak, ineffectual United States, right, that continues to invest in China so that China can use American dollars to modernize and expand its military, steal our intellectual property, conduct cyber espionage, all those sorts of things, they love that. So what they're gleeful about is any distraction that kind of hobbles the United States from being an effective, influential, powerful, you know, global force for good, in truth, is a good day for China. So, you know, we've got a small military, about half the size of what is during the Cold War. If we are now kind of fixated on what's going on in Europe, then we have less flexibility to respond to things in the Indo-Pacific region. So if China wanted to extend its reach to take Taiwan, strengthen its grip, its stranglehold that it has on Hong Kong, and the other things that it's doing, then these sorts of things that Putin is doing in Europe are a good day for China.
Yeah, we may see that too. Let me grab a caller, too. We have a few moments if you want to get in. It's 888-914-9149. Dee Dee, who listens in Phoenix, Arizona, has got a question for you. Hi, Dee Dee.
Hello. My question is, I have a couple of nephews just turned 19, 20. But my question is, might the United States consider reinstating the draft of our young men? That's my concern.
Well, nobody is talking about dramatically expanding the U.S. military. So we have the selective service system where young men on the age of 18, you know, register for that. So if the government needed something, reaching out and pulling them in. But nobody is talking about that at all. We would have sufficient military as is to respond to a single major crisis if we were all in. Now, beyond that, we would need to expand. And whether people were registered or not, because of criminal records, substance abuse, obesity, and other health problems, only about a quarter of American military youth between the ages of 18 and 24 would even be eligible for military service. I mean, so we've got other issues in our younger demographic here in America that we really need to understand and deal with, you know, and good diets and exercise and civic virtue and those sorts of things. Amen. So I don't think we're anywhere near, you know, drafting people and bringing them into the military. But if we did have to go that route, global emergency, and we would have to deal with some challenges here at home.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Hey, I only have a few minutes. I just want to get your sense on what might happen next. We're going to apply these sanctions. They're going to ratchet up. They're going to become more intense on the oligarchy over there in Russia, and in particular in Vladimir Putin and that country. Will we see cyber attacks on the U.S.? I mean, I remember the Colonial Pipeline got hacked. It cost fuel to go up to $7 a gallon in some parts of the country. I wonder if, you know, we won't see a missile fly, but we might see some attacks on infrastructure or something else here in the country. What do you know about that? What are your concerns, if any?
Yeah, well, I think those should be expected, especially if the United States actually moves effectively. To your first comment there, I don't think Vladimir Putin gives a hoot about these sanctions that have been announced. You know, sanctioning any business in these areas already occupied by Russia, mm-hmm. nobody's doing business there anyway. You're know, right. I mean, they're ineffectual. Biden and his cronies are all billionaires. You know, they're not going to affect him. They can go for years and years to the end of their life, you know, and not lose a nickel. So I don't think the economic sanctions are going to do anything unless we really go whole hog, which we need to do, and cut them off from the international banking system and cut them off from the energy markets. That would cause a problem that they would it would wake them up. So I do think that cyber threat is very real. Probably cyber attacks against satellites to kind of blind us in those areas and maybe make it difficult to move communications around the planet. We should probably expect that. The beauty and the horror of cyber is that it's very hard to attribute an attack, you know, against a state entity. You know, you could pay a private company to do stuff and they can route their stuff through 100 different servers and you might not even know where it's ever coming from. But you could do a power grid inside the United States, banking infrastructure, our health networks. You know, if a hospital can't exchange data and operated systems, how do you provide for public health and stuff? So there are multiple venues that could be at risk of that. And we should not be surprised if the United States responds more aggressively to see that kind of response from Moscow.
Well, Dakota, thank you for your insight, your expertise, your service, and your time. It is always a delight to have you here, and I'm grateful for it. We're about to pray the chapel. I'll remember your intentions along with mine. Check them out at the Heritage Foundation.